Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing Dr. John Goodall about his book titled The Castle, A History, published by Yale University Press in 2022. As you can probably expect from the title, this book presents a vibrant history of the castle in Britain from the early Middle Ages all the way to the present. I found this book absolutely fascinating. Because it covers both kind of the castle in general and how it's perceived and built and used, as well as a ton of specific examples of actual castles, some of which are not as old as I expected, some of which had different stories than I expected. So I enjoyed this book thoroughly, and I think you, the listener, will also learn a lot from this. So John, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the podcast.
Miranda, thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Could we please start off with you introducing yourself and explain why you decided to write this book?
So I trained, as it were, as a medievalist, and I worked briefly for English Heritage as a historian. I launched their new guidebook series. I was one of the people involved in doing that more years ago than I care to think of. Must be about 15, 20 years ago. And that was, in a way, the sort of hook that got me first interested in castles, you know, looking at these buildings, trying to understand them, trying to write guidebooks about them. I like to think of guidebooks as a unique technical literature because they're the only kind of literature that is meant to be read in a particular place. And the challenges of trying to convey what castles, you know, mean in guidebooks was sort of a starting point for my own interest and the technical details of that. From there, I moved to my present job, which is the architectural editor of Country Life. And I work each week producing an article on buildings of different kinds, often country houses, but things that could be built in the distant past and the present. And the point about that, I suppose, is it broadened my interest in architecture from the foundations in the Middle Ages, which I studied before, and medieval buildings, to buildings of every period. And so this particular project brought together those two interests in a way. It brought together, on the one hand, technical and archaeological interest in castles, but then allied it with an interest in how they fit in the grand traditions of domestic architecture in the British Isles. This book really focuses on English castles. I actually cover buildings, as I say, right across the British Isles in Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England. But it's a sort of convenient way of dealing with something briefly, because all these different areas, of course, have their own traditions of building. And what I wanted to do, in effect, therefore, in this book was to try and look at the castle across time, from the distant past to the present day. I also wanted to look at it not just in literal history, but in literary history. So it contains buildings both, you know, that exist physically and those that have been imagined at different periods of time. And then finally, as an architectural historian, I spend all my time necessarily turning the buildings I love into words. And words are necessarily so much less interesting than buildings. But one way, you can never avoid that, but one way I think of blunting your own use of words is to try and turn to the words of different generations of people as they've described castles. So this book, the skeleton of this book, is really a whole series of narratives taken from everything from chronicles to newspaper accounts, poetry, novels of different periods, which describe castles through other people's eyes. It's about how people in the distant past have perceived these things, or and how they've presented them. So it's basically a long chronology with a whole series of anecdotes which I interpret and explain and relate in the words of the person who has presented them. And I hoped in that way that I could do something in short that was, you know, rooted in one side in one part in rigorous architectural history, but also rooted in many voices of the past, and also took a very broad view of a subject that commands still enormous popular interest. So it's also meant to be a popular and accessible book, and writing a history, I suppose, in a slightly different way.
Well, that's a very helpful introduction to kind of what brought you to this, and also a really lovely summary of the book, not just in its content, but also the way it conveys that content, which I'd love to ask you about in a minute. But before that, given, as you've just described, the massive kind of sweep of the book in time, in geography, could we first start off with just clarifying, how do we define the term castle?
Yes, this wonderful old chestnut. The book, I suppose, starts, from the point of view that it has become conventional to define the castle as the residence of a nobleman that is defensible. And that conventional description is, in fact, I think, perfectly accurate of buildings, castle buildings in the early Middle Ages in England. But it becomes very complicated in the late, even by the 13th century, I think it becomes complicated because it's involved scholars in discussions of whether fortifications function. And that's a very subjective and difficult thing to judge. And my own preferred way of approaching this problem, therefore, is to say that if people call things a castle, it's not the responsibility of historians to tell them why they got it wrong. It's the responsibility of historians to explain what they meant. And I think, obviously, the word castle has been very widely applied in to buildings in England through long periods of time. And what I've settled for is the definition of a castle as a building made magnificent through the trappings of fortification. So the residence of a nobleman made magnificent through the trappings of fortification. And in changing it, the definition from the conventional one in this way, I think we sidestep, first of all, a huge amount of very subjective discussion about whether a particular fortification actually works, and therefore whether it's a real castle, in inverted commas, or by implication a fake one. But also it's possible to look at a much wider spectrum of buildings than those that are constructed in the 11th and 12th centuries, where clearly defence is a very important element. But even in those buildings, I would say, this architecture has never been purely functional. It's always had a demonstrative quality. And I think that that's actually, really the most important quality of the castle. It is a demonstrative building. And so that's ultimately that's what I've plumbed for is the definition of a castle that is a building, a nobleman's residence that uses the trappings of fortification, battlements, towers, turrets to demonstrative effect as an expression of social identity, but also, which can sometimes function as defensible buildings. And one of the themes, of course, that's picked up in the book is that it can be quite shocking to discover how late people were still building castles with a defensive function sometimes. It can be quite remarkable to be reminded of 19th century buildings that are, they're not meant to withstand attacks from armies, but they're certainly intended to withstand attacks from mobs. Defence never quite vanishes, but I mean, I think it's certainly a thing of diminishing importance. And this book is trying to set the specific issue of defence to one side without denying its importance, but saying that there's something even more profound that identifies a castle today. And of course, the irony is that they are instantaneously recognisable to us as a building type. Whether or not you're professionally interested in the subject, I think we all know what castles are inwardly.
which in a lot of ways means that defining it is even trickier, because we do have kind of built-in connotations and assumptions that make someone, you know, someone like you, it's harder then to come up with a definition because there's already so many out there. So thank you for sort of providing us with that baseline to understand the rest of this. The other kind of foundational question I wanted to ask sort of comes back to something you were mentioning earlier around kind of the goals of the book, not just purely being about kind of, I don't know, a textbook going along with, you know, year by year what's happening, but the idea of kind of unearthing voices from the past and putting them kind of in conversation with each other. And the book does, in a lot of ways, work chronologically, but you also do organize it in other ways. And I was wondering if you could sort of tell us a little bit about kind of how you group castles together, how you organize them, how you think about them as you are structuring the book.
Well, I suppose as I was structuring the book, what I was really trying to do first and foremost was create a chronology. I wanted to have stories that talked about castles from, you know, the early Middle Ages right through to the present day. And, you know, without giving anything away, you know, the first quotations in the book is in fact from Caesar's Gallic Wars, and the last is a discussion of the Disney castle, because I suppose that's another point that, you know, we're still creating castles. It's not as though they've vanished. I was trying to find things that furnished a broad chronology, and that's actually always agonizing, because there were all sorts of things that I would have loved to have included, but they fell too close to other things that I thought were more important. And that was a slightly agonizing series of choices when I was trying to really whittle things down. You know, there are some periods of time where narratives are packed with references to castles, and there are other periods of time where you have to seek out references to castles. So that was the main, you know, imperative, I suppose, in structuring the book, was trying to create a balance in time to make it clear what the sweep of the book actually was, the breadth of the subject and what it was covering. I also think that buildings are one of the ways in which we get closer to the physical experience, the reality of the past, than anywhere else. I mean, I think when we confront paintings, open manuscripts, or we visit buildings, we are brought face to face with the visual world, in as far as we can be, that people in the past have known and experienced. And so I wanted not only to incorporate within the book quotations from past, you know, from accounts of castles, but I thought it was also important at certain points to use images of castles or photographs of existing buildings to illustrate the narrative. So they also fall into that overarching chronology, you know, images of castles at different periods of time. It's not that I think that images are separate, quite the contrary, but I was almost trying to cast images and real buildings as texts, just as the other things were as texts that you could gloss and analyse. I think it's really important that you try and stop and gloss and text what you see in images and in buildings that you visit. So those, I suppose, were the two groups of things. And as I've said already, you know, I was very conscious that I wanted to cover imaginary buildings as well as real ones, literary castles, as you know, and also one of the things that I think has been very important in the story of the castle, and is again, I think, lives in the Disney castle, for example, is the castle as a sort of foundation of myth and fantasy. You know, castles very early on in English history become associated with the foundational legends of Britain, figures such as King Arthur. And I think it's very important that that sort of fictional character of history is represented as well in a history of the castle. It's really, really significant. I don't think we always, you know, when I was writing guidebooks for English Heritage, I used to think that there was a thing called, you know, the real history of a site. And then all these other things, all these other stories that people invented about castles or monasteries and buildings. Now, it's not that I don't think that is a real distinction. I think, you know, there's history as invention and there is history as, you know, factually related. But sometimes I notice that the distinction between them is not as clear as I used to think. I think also So I suppose I feel sensitized to the reality that when people think things about buildings, those things can seem real to them. I mean, people from the 13th century thought that the Tower of London was built by Julius Caesar. And if you're going to understand the Tower of London through their eyes, you need to make their mistake. You know, we now know that it's not a Roman building, but that doesn't mean that people who thought it, you can't understand people who thought it was a Roman building if you insist on in some way discounting their perception of it. You need to make the same mistakes as the past if you're going to understand the past, I think.
I think that makes a lot of sense, especially kind of put in the context of understanding and interpreting images as well. Because, of course, photography is not around for a lot of the history of the castle. And so a lot of the images in the book are sketches or are kind of other methods of documenting images. And that, in a lot of ways, tells us more about what people thought about castles necessarily than kind of an accurate architectural rendering of sort of a military fortification. So I think kind of all this goes together and sort of helping us understand kind of the castle in and of itself, but also like the history and the way people have talked about and perceived castles. So I'd love to kind of, I mean, you had to write a proper chronology looking at really all the castles. I do not have that burden. So I am going to explicitly, essentially cherry pick through the chronology that the book provides. In the interest of time, we obviously can't go into all of it. So I'm going to pick bits of this history to ask you to tell us a little bit more about. And kind of the obvious place to start is, of course, the Norman Conquest. So traditionally, we perhaps understand that castles kind of come to England through the Norman Conquest. That's where the English and then the British castle comes from. To what extent is that actually true?
Yes, well, this is another really complex issue, and it comes down in part to the question of, you know, what do we mean by the word castle? How is the word castle actually used? I think the basic premise that the castle is a building type introduced to England at the Norman Conquest is correct. But it is important to acknowledge that there are complications to it. One of those complications is that there are Normans who are brought to England before the conquest happens. Edward the Confessor, the last Anglo-Saxon king of England, is, of course, spends some of his life in exile in Normandy. And he brings back to England, when he becomes king, all kinds of things that savour of the sort of Norman cultural revolution. And one of those, of course, famously not in the world of castles at all, is his rebuilding of Westminster Abbey, which is in this new style, which is informed by the Romanesque, Roman architecture, and is effectively a building of Norman inspiration before the Norman conquest. So one complication, in other words, is that there are Normans around and there are a handful of castles constructed by foreigners in England before the Norman conquest itself. But it's also true to say that the Anglo-Saxon nobility do live in buildings that are defensible. And the name of them, the Burgheat, which literally means the gateway to the enclosure, this actually is a building type that's clearly defensible. And the Anglo-Saxons, after all, you know, have long been building fortifications against the Vikings, apart from anything else. So there are fortifications in England, and they do occur sometimes around residences. I use in the book the example of Bamburgh. What we're told by the Venerable Bede is that this citadel, but named after Bebba, Queen Bebba of Bernicia, Bebba's Burr. And there's a siege described by Bede when the King of Mercia, Penda, tries to destroy the fortifications by creating an enormous bonfire. What's sort of fascinating about this early description of this fortified site, which sounds like a citadel of some kind, is that it doesn't really conform to what we think of. There's a castle built there after the conquest, of course, but it long precedes castle building. It's odd, however, that the siege that Penda undertakes, you know, it really has none of the qualities of a siege that you would read in the later Middle Ages. You know, there aren't catapults or anything like that. It's tremendously passive. You know, Penda basically pulls down all the neighbouring houses, stacks them up to form a bonfire, waits until the wind is in the right direction and sets fire to them. This is not the stuff of sieges that we're familiar with. And I think herein lies one of the most interesting distinctions between sort of pre- and post-Norman conquest castles, if you want to call them all that, is that before the Norman conquest, there are fortifications and there are residences that are fortified, but they don't really turn up very often in narratives, of historical narratives, and they certainly aren't often the objects of sieges. But after the Norman conquest, this building type turns up absolutely everywhere. You know, the narratives and chronicles of the period are full of references to castles, and they're being besieged so much more actively. They're you know, elements in warfare. And that's not just a matter of the increased surviving evidence. It really does seem to be a reflection of the way in which they're being used as tools in war. So, in other words, there is a very complex history. And as a final, actually, sorry, the final thing I should say is that, just to confuse matters even further, that the English tradition of noblemen's residences, the Anglo-Saxon tradition, does seem to feed into Norman castle building in architectural terms. So we know that an English noble residence before the conquest often has a great hall, which is where feudal dues, you know, that's the sort of focus of a manor, is a hall, a building, and that these fortified houses, these burgeats, have prominent gatehouses. And it is striking that in England, when the Normans build, they often build castles with gatehouses of a kind and scale you never see in continental Europe. And they also construct halls on a scale and in a form that you don't see elsewhere in France. So it's as though English traditions and English ideas permeate the castle building tradition of the post-conquest period. So there are really complex relationships between them. But I think it is still fair to say that the Norman conquest does really constitute a new beginning.
I think that idea of permeating is very interesting. And as of course, the book goes on, there's a lot of examples, particularly around the halls of castles and kind of what they're used for and what we think they're used for later on. As you said, sort of thinking the Tower of London was built by Caesar, historical assumptions about what has happened in castles is not always correct, but that can be really interesting, especially around kind of big theatrical spaces in a way, and kind of, well, what would they have looked like? So I think it's really interesting to kind of think about, like, where does the idea of a hall come from? So thank you for kind of explaining that it's, as you said, it's complex. It's not quite as simple as the myth we may be used to. So I'd love to turn then to the sort of the other group of people involved, right? We've talked about it as noblemen's residences, but of course they're not the only people living in a castle, living near castles, encountering castles, particularly in this kind of early period, you know, before we can talk about maybe sort of mass literacy or pamphlets, and certainly long before we can talk about sort of leisure travel. What did ordinary people think of castles, respond to them, the view of them, the building of them? We've talked about for warriors, but like, what did normal everyday people think?
Yes, well, I think this is a really important point to make. And one of the things that I find, where I found that this idea of using other people's voices is very helpful. Because for some people, of course, castles are home. For some people, they're places that, you know, they can live out grand lives. But there's, as you say, there are other people for whom castles are places where justice is meted out, or they can be seen, I mean, throughout the Middle Ages too, as tools of tyranny. And I mean, I think that's true from the Norman conquest onwards, you know, that this sense that when the Normans start building castles in England, this is not some, you know, this is not a sort of byproduct of conquest. This is actually completely fundamental to the process. You're forcing people to come off the land to build fortifications for you. It's really brutal. And we're told by the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, you know, that it's oppressive, it's tyrannous, that people are being forced to work on castles. And that theme of the castle as a place of tyranny and of a threatening building, of course, another anecdote I tell in the book is about Henry III's rebuilding of the Tower of London with my daughter coming into the room. Henry III building the Tower of London and the citizens of London being terrified by the reality of having this castle being built beside them. They think it's going to be used to tyrannize over them. And there's this wonderful story of Thomas Becket, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's a born a Londoner and is always a supporter of the citizens of London, and who knocks in a dream, is seen to knock down the castle walls of the Tower of London. And this happens on two consecutive occasions, exactly a year apart. And amazingly, I think people long thought that this was just a sort of medieval myth, but during excavations at the Tower of London, it turned out that there really were fortifications being built by Edward III that fell down twice. So this story is suddenly linked, to archaeology. It's rather fascinating. And in the book itself, of course, I go on to talk about castles and their perception as places of tyranny. I cite a passage from John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which illustrates again the soul Christian and hopeful, his companion, who are on this metaphorical journey to heaven, are imprisoned in a castle. And I tell that anecdote. And this is, again, a story of tyranny. So this is where the other side to the castle from the setting of grand life. And there are also, references to castles as seats of judicial authority, and the rather wonderful story of a rather sad story of a lady who's killed by a kettle, killed by a stone that falls out of a castle in Wales, and the person who throws the stone or who dislodges the stone is the castle constable of Montgomery Castle, and the law case brought by this woman's daughter is heard within the walls of the castle in which her mother was killed. Again, reminder of the judicial function of these buildings.
Thank you for explaining kind of the range of interactions and reactions, and of course that many of those can be kind of all experienced by the same person, right? It could be a place of work that also becomes a place of justice that maybe starts off or becomes a place of tyranny. It's all sort of interconnected and there's not just one way to look at it. So I'm really, thank you for kind of explaining that to us. And of course, for threading that throughout the book, not just in the kind of early medieval stuff. So it is really something that is present throughout, which is helpful because ordinary people were present throughout, despite what we may tend to think about in terms of castles. I'd like to move then to kind of my next question, which is, I suppose, still in the realm, I guess, of myth busting, really, which is the idea of something called a license to crenellate. What was that in actual fact?
So this is a very complicated thing. I mean, in the 19th century, where people were obsessed by the idea, not obsessed, they regarded castles as a decentralizing force on the life of the realm, because if you owned a castle and you could resist the king and withdraw into your castle and live independently. And so it was believed that all castles had to be licensed when the crown was strong enough. The crown insisted on licensing all castles, and people began to look through documentary material to identify a category of document that they described after a phrase that often appears in licenses to build fortifications as a license to crenellate. Now, licenses to crenellate, so-called, are issued between, they appear in the, in documentation issued by the Chancery, and also by certain palatine powers, princely powers in England, from the 12th century onwards. But in fact, they're not a natural category. They're sort of a selected category. It's what historians have chosen sort of to bring together. And the main group of them belong to a particular period of time and follow a particular formula that often allows people to build stone walls and erect crenellations on them around their residences. Now, when it was believed that the king needed to control his realm by restricting the construction of fortifications, it was thought that a licensed crenellate was a sort of gracious, you know, royal gift. But it's quite clear now that many of the licenses to crenellate that were issued were in fact really being issued like licenses for anything else. You went to the chancery and you paid a fine sum of money, and they would write a license for you according to whatever you'd asked for, if you provided enough money. And so what in fact licenses to crenellate really are is not the king allowing people to build castles and, by limiting the construction of castles, organising and maintaining law and order in the realm. They're in fact documents issued by the Royal Chancery in response to people who want to build castles as a sign that they are of the requisite status, a nobleman, to live in a castle. They're a sort of passport to social status. And they are often also issued with other rights and privileges. Markets, for example, the right to hold markets, or another also rights to create parks for the aristocratic privilege of hunting. So again, you know, they are much more sort of passports to social status than anything else. And of course, the irony about licenses to crenellate is not only are they issued over a limited period of time. I mean, those that have been identified spread really between the late 12th and the very latest ones are the early 17th century. But the point is that lots and lots of people build things that they call castles, which don't have any licenses to crenellate associated with them at all. Noblemen, for example, very, very rarely bothered to get a license to crenellate, and they tend to live in castles without these ever being issued, and build new castles without them being issued. So the license to crenellate has gone from being a sort of indication that the king is ruling effectively and controlling his baronies, his barons, to being really, you know, passports to status and privilege.
Mm. Speaking of the king controlling baronies and castles, I'd love to ask about how castles were impacted by the English Civil War.
Yes, well, the English Civil War is a sort of, in architectural terms, architectural historical terms, is a major sort of caesura in the history of English building. It's a counterpart, a secular counterpart, really, to the dissolution of the monasteries. For one thing, until the Civil War, there are lots of great medieval castles that in one way or another have remained major residences since time immemorial. They've just kind of kept on going. And at the Civil War, those buildings, some of them are obviously fortified with garrisons, often along with towns. I mean, I think I should say that we tend to read about Civil War sieges of castles and we think of the castles themselves as being surrounded. But I think the narratives that I've read often imply that the garrisons occupy much bigger sites than the castles alone. Often the towns as well are enclosed by fortifications, so the castle is sort of an element of the defences. So some of these castles, anyway, in the Civil War play an active role in the fighting. But in the aftermath of the fighting, huge numbers of them are destroyed by Act of Parliament. And it's really interesting that owners of these buildings often, you know, are content to see castles demolished because they're understood somehow to be a potential cause for the fighting being perpetuated. You know, if you can have a small force of people and you can get into a castle and then resist central authority. So quite a lot of people are willing to see castle defences damaged or slighted so that the castle can no longer effectively operate as a place of defence. Now, I think it's important to say that you know, again, the conventional view is that castles are very effective until gunpowder is developed. The sieges of the Civil War demonstrate that plenty of medieval castles constructed long before the use of gunpowder were incredibly effective as places of defence. And even castles that were not, even buildings that weren't really designed as defensible places. Some medieval buildings, you know, were proved incredibly strong in the face even of gunpowder. But it's also true that, you know, the sieges that took place very often in the English Civil War, until you got an artillery train to a particular castle, it could hold out almost indefinitely. And it's really the artillery that eventually subdues most castles. So, you know, what you have in the Civil War is that castles become centres of defence once again. Some of them are ruins, some of them are genuinely, you know, occupied places. Basing House, for example, one of the great lost buildings of Tudor England, probably, is of course the subject of a very celebrated and bitter and cruelly concluded siege, brutally concluded siege. Huge numbers of these buildings after the fighting are then deliberately destroyed. And in that destruction, there is a complete change in the direction of English domestic, English domestic architecture. When the Restoration comes, you know, there are lots of people who have been in exile abroad and have seen continental taste, Baroque palaces and so on and so forth. They come back and they find their ancestral homes in ruins, and they don't particularly want to rebuild them, and they build something completely different as a consequence. So the Civil War is sort of hugely important. It's a moment where buildings, the castles which have for very, very long periods of time been developed generation after generation with fashionable new additions and basically parked and then demolished, and then there's a new beginning. And that, you know, in that sense, the Restoration, to speak in general terms, really is a restoration in all kinds of ways. But it's more than a restoration. It's almost a new departure. It's a moment where the English nobility really start living completely differently in totally new buildings almost overnight. I mean, there's a massive change that takes place. And famously, even a castle such as Windsor, you know, this great emblem of royal authority, it very, very narrowly escapes demolition. The parks associated with it are partitioned up. And at the Restoration, you know, it's all put back together. But it takes a little bit of time. Charles II only kind of returns to Windsor properly when he feels threatened by London mobs. And he moves to Windsor as a place of security. And it's refashioned as a great Baroque palace. It never loses its title as being a castle. You know, I don't think, again, it's not necessarily a building that would serve in a major campaign against armies, but it is a security against mobs. And he definitely uses it in that way.
So given that there's now been this big change in how the nobility kind of sees castles and the utility of castles, how are castles then impacted by the Gothic revival?
Well, the Gothic revival, of course, revives people's interests in castles in all kinds of, you know, quite complex ways. One of them, again, is the Gothic novel, and this is to do, again, with the idea of castles as places of tyranny. And that is a romantic perception of them, informed famously by, Horace Walpole's first Gothic novel, The Castle of Otranto. But there is another side to the Gothic revival, and that's a sort of reinvigoration in. It's a return of interest in the Middle Ages as a living and breathing entity, sort of history as something that we can experience and imagine, reimagine in our mind's eye. An absolutely crucial figure in this process is Walter Scott, the novelist, and his novels, which turn castles and historic, you know, environments into places where people live, love, and die. And, you know, the enormous popularity that his novels enjoyed, again, in a romantic sense, they made castles seem to live again. And there were circles who, you know, largely fired by the novels of Walter Scott and others, you know, all the things are sort of associated with that romantic revival, that made people want to revive the social orders and the architecture of the Middle Ages. I mean, some people idealized this in the most extraordinary way and saw in the Middle Ages a perfect society or a better society than the one in which they inhabited. So the Gothic Revival, not only, I mean, in many ways, I think we're familiar with the Gothic Revival in church buildings and, you know, the restoration of cathedrals and so on and so forth in the 19th century. But it also has this other side where people begin to build castles, and they don't even only build castles. I mean, they begin to dress up in medieval costume. There, you know, Queen Victoria, early in her reign, has a celebrated fancy dress costume, a ball, effectively, which she turns up as Philippa of Hainault to Albert's Edward III. You know, all and their portrait is painted in these elaborate costumes, and everybody comes in medievalizing costumes. And one of the episodes I talk about in the book is a description of the so-called Eglinton Tournament, which is a mock tournament. Well, not a mock tournament, it's a tournament in which lots of particularly young Tory sympathizing noblemen get together in the lowlands of Scotland, and they have a tournament to celebrate the coronation of the Queen, which they think has been done in a very sort of cheapskate way. And so they have they literally revive the Middle Ages for a few days. The most famous thing about the Eglinton Tournament is on the first day it poured with rain and absolutely ruined the first day of the event. But in fact, huge numbers of people turned up to this tournament. And in the subsequent days, there were lots of jousting, and feasting and feats of martial arms and so on and so forth. And the people who turn up are a really extraordinary list of the great and the good in European terms. Napoleon III, for example, who goes on to restore castles such as Pierrefonds in France, is one of the people there, and he takes part in the tournament. And so there are really very significant figures who go on to restore castles and build castles. It really fires their imagination, this idea that the Middle Ages is a period that you can recreate, and the idea of chivalry. And it's a subject that's been beautifully written about both by Marc Girard and more recently by Rosemary Hill in her more recent book about, you know, the romantic period of history, the sort of antiquarianism, not as a dry study, but as somehow a full-bodied attempt to imagine the past and relive the past sometimes.
But this is still, in a lot of ways, quite a step from what we currently have in sort of English heritage, National Trust sort of things, of preserving historically accurately, or preserving kind of in full these historical sites. And we can kind of almost see that progression in the answers you've already said, right? At first, it's about building up in response to military events, in response to kind of social status. Then it's a change from the restoration of, wait, there are other options. Then it's this revival of kind of, oh, we could do that. Let's build things like it or as if. But now we have a very sort of different sense in some ways of kind of combining in some sense this fancy dress, but also with kind of preserving the historical accuracy. How do we end up with this sort of idea of preserving castles? How did we kind of come to think of that as a thing? How do we come to think of that as a thing that we do now?
Well, it is in a way a product of exactly the same thing. I mean, I think the idea that we preserve monuments as we do is partly born of people's changing attitudes to churches and things. You know, there's a belief in the authenticity of the original material, and the idea that you need to preserve the original because it has authenticity and it brings you back to the past. I mean, I think that it is fascinating because our whole treatment of buildings is so it involves tensions between so many different interests. I mean, there is particularly, I suppose, English heritage historically was very concerned that the ruins of buildings should be presented as texts of history. This is an idea that's first, you know, being expressed in the late 19th century, that the original material is just like a text, and that if it's properly presented, you can read it as another historical document of the past. And in the early 20th century, particularly when the Ministry of Works, as it then was taking lots of buildings into its care, what it would do is it would find a building, and then it would take away all the things that it thought of as accretions to its central history. Let's say if it's a monastery, you clear the site, you get rid of everything that's post-medieval because it's not to do with the monastery, and then you present these ruins. Now, the problem with that is that it creates very arid remains, and ruins don't maintain themselves. In more recent years, there's been a great interest in trying to make ruins and history live again. And this is, again, taking us back to the idea of the romantic past, the idea that you can go to a place and imagine what life was like there. It's a very, in many ways, a very 19th century sensibility. And so, national institutions, including Historic Scotland and English Heritage, have attempted reconstructions of historic interiors. And those are, they're completely fascinating, but they're also deeply problematic because often they reconstruct historic interiors in ways that nobody in history would recognize them, because they are, again, demonstrative reconstructions of the past rather than, real living reconstructions of the past. But of course, in some cases, if you go to historical palaces or something, you can go into reconstructed rooms and there will be people dressed in period costume to explain the contents of those rooms. Seems to me, in its own terms, a very successful thing to do. There are, of course, another group of buildings which are still lived-in castles, that still have families occupying them. I mean, I think that we tend to forget that in England, these things all do live side by side. And I think it's a curiosity, actually, in one way, of some of the recent problems facing, heritage organisations as they try and interpret the past in the face of debates about, Black Lives Matter and slavery and things, is that private families were some of the first, families living in stately homes and in castles were some of the first to pioneer studies into their families' connections with the slave trade. For example, somewhere like Lowther, for example, was looking into this long before or Harwood, long before any institutions turned their attention to it. And the curious thing is, even now, families, I think, are able to deal with difficult pasts with much more kind of conviction than institutions. Institutions just seem to be terrified by them because they don't know where to look or how to justify it. Families seem to have no problem in saying, yes, we had, my great-great-great-grandfather was a completely awful person and did these terrible things. And of course, I wouldn't do that now, but it's just part of my family's history. Whereas institutions say that the great-great-grandfather of the present owner, or the occupant in the early, late 19th century was awful, and therefore we sort of can't even present them anymore. So I think there are interesting ways in which institutions and family histories can sort of learn from one another. I think that full spread of material is really fascinating, that we have houses or castles that are ruins, castles that are still occupied, castles that are recreations. They all exist in a very, very rich combination of material, I think.
Definitely, very much so, particularly as they all can often be in like similar geographies. You can get to kind of a ruin and a currently occupied castle and a sort of restored place like quite easily often, and are very much geographically in conversation with each other. So it would make sense to kind of have more conversation and dialogue between them as well. But as we come toward to the end of it, I'm wondering if I can just ask you to give us a little bit more detail on something you briefly mentioned around kind of the reconstruction of the interiors being problematic. And you've just outlined really helpfully kind of how discussions about sort of nasty people in the past are being had in different ways, some more productive than others. But I'm wondering if you can maybe help us understand, perhaps through an example, kind of this idea of where and why we might want to be critical about historically constructed interiors and how that may not actually be as representative as it sounds like.
Well, I suppose, it's very difficult discussing historically reconstructed interiors because I think there's always a conflation of arguments. One is about the quality of the scholarship and the quality of the craftsmanship that underpins the recreation of a period apartment. And the other is the question of whether it's actually accurate, whether it actually shows anything that we know about. Now, it seems to me that in recent years, there have been lots of really exemplary projects in terms of academic research and craftsmanship. And I mean, I could name, let's say, Stirling Castle in Scotland, or, you know, the restoration of the 12th century rooms in Dover Castle, or Historic Royal Palace's work at in the Tower of London. But I think in all those different cases, the problem is that it doesn't, if you go in there with a sort of critical mind and say, is this actually a path that ever existed? You would be very hard pressed to answer yes to that question. And there are little details, I think, that, you know, that underline that point. I mean, one of the most obvious ones is that English kings and queens, historically, and noblemen, were very, very rich and powerful people. They possessed objects of enormous value in their own societies. Now, we simply don't have, when reconstructing the rooms in the keep at Dover, you know, English heritage doesn't have the money of Henry II. It can't recreate the kinds of objects that he would have possessed and used. And it certainly couldn't put them on public display just for the reasons of their bullion value alone. So, you know, you can reconstruct those apartments to the very highest standards of academic, you know, work and to very high standards of craftsmanship, recreating beds and hangings and textiles and fabrics. But, you know, it still, in a way, I don't think necessarily gives a flavour of what it would have been like actually to be in the presence of Henry II in the keep in Dover. And there are also, I think, in the process of these reconstructions, I think they telescope time and often involve little, you know, changes that are important. So, for example, again, I'm not having it in for Dover because, I mean, I very much enjoy it. But, you know, there is no evidence that the keep at Dover ever had 12th century fireplaces. There were fireplaces created there in the 15th century, and those are the fireplaces that are now used in the display of the 12th century rooms. Well, that's fine, but it's actually really interesting that there aren't any fireplaces in Dover in the 12th century. And added to which, by presenting the rooms in the 12th century, you're compressing or sort of effacing the fact that the keep at Dover has actually been used as a royal palace right the way through the Middle Ages. It's remodeled by Edward IV in the 1470s. It's also then used by Henry VIII as a palace. It's also the place where Charles I first meets his bride in the 17th century when it's reworked as a palace. And it then has a history of all kinds of other things into the 20th century. So when you take this back just to one period of time, it seems to me you're also denying the depths of history that that building represents. So I think that's quite confusing in a way. And it also ignores all kinds of, you know, physical things within the building that have, you know, changed over that time. So I think it's a really complicated tightrope trying to reconstruct things, you know, convincingly. And it has, of course, a very long history. I mean, the Marquess of Bute was doing this kind of thing at Cardiff and Castell Coch in the mid-19th century. I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. It's complicated. As I say, I think that we run the risk often of constructing historic interiors, in inverted commas, that no person in history would recognise. It's difficult. It's worthwhile too. I mean, I think you only learn. I don't want to sound down about it entirely, because I think it's a process full of really interesting insights when you try and reconstruct rooms in the past. But it's a very difficult thing to do successfully, and always it seems to me they date very fast. They look their time very, very, very quickly. And that's true of 19th century reconstructions of buildings, but it will be true of 20th and 21st century reconstructions too. You'll just go in there and you'll immediately know when it was done.
Well, I think that's in many ways a really interesting kind of encapsulation of a lot of what the book does, is deal with an incredibly complex topic that has a lot of different facets, but lays it out clearly, not to reduce the complexity, but to make that complexity understandable without kind of saying there's one right answer. So I think that's a lovely place to kind of wrap up with that kind of thing that helps us understand today as we're encountering some of these places, what we might want to be thinking about, and sort of end with that lovely taste of sort of how the book deals with these complex issues. But before I let you go, I was wondering if you might be able to share with us, now that the book is published, what you might be working on now or next.
Gosh, well, I'm working for a weekly magazine. I'm just always working on lots and lots of different things. It's a slightly overwhelming question. I mean, I've absolutely on my desk at the present moment is a pair of articles on Hocum Hall in Norfolk. But I mean, I do have plans for another book. And I mean, one thing I would be very interested in trying to do is a history of maybe the perpendicular style of architecture, late Gothic architecture in England. It's a subject that is, I think, of great interest at the present moment. And I've even seen newspaper articles on it recently. And it's not a very popular area of study. But I haven't really formulated what I might do, but it is something that would be of interest to me.
Fair enough. Well, best of luck with that and with your weekly articles. And in the meantime, while you're off doing all of that, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, which, as a reminder, is titled The Castle, A History, published by Yale University Press in 2022. Dr. John Goodall, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. That's very kind.